Welcome to the telebriefing on the new CDC study, funded by CDC, Obesity and Severe Obesity Forecast through 2030. My name is Jeff McKenna, and I'm from the CDC's National Center for Chronic Disease Prevention and Health Promotion. And we'll hear this morning from two speakers, Dr. Bill Dietz, who directs CDC's Division of Nutrition, Physical Activity, and Obesity, will make some brief opening remarks, and then Eric Finkelstein, the director and associate research professor at Duke's Global Health Institute and the lead author of the paper, will present some remarks. We'll then open it up for questions. We also have with us at the front Dr. Justin Trogdon, who's a research economist and a senior author on the paper from Research Triangle Institute. And if you were able to hear the plenary presentation across the hall just a few minutes ago, you heard Justin present the findings to the whole conference attendees. So we'll start with Dr. Dietz.
Thank you, Jeff. And thank you, Justin, for that presentation this morning. It really is a great pleasure to be here and to discuss these issues again. As you saw this morning, there's some evidence that at the very least, the curve of the increase may have changed, and at best, there may be a plateau, in contrast to the findings in this study, which start from a different perspective. And we're happy to address the differences in these two studies. But regardless of which is correct, we still have a very serious problem, because even if we are at a plateau, 34% of adults and 17% of children and adolescents are still obese and still generating very substantial costs, as our paper that Eric and I were co-authors on. Eric was the lead author in 2009, and that paper demonstrated that the cost of obesity were about $150 billion a year, or 10%, almost 10% of the annual healthcare budget. Interestingly enough, since that time, there have been other estimates which suggest that that what we published were underestimates, and when you correct for a variety of other factors, those costs may be twofold greater. But the real platform here belongs to Eric and Justin, who were the chief authors of this study. So let me turn to them.
Sure. So welcome, everyone, and thanks for the opportunity to allow us to talk a little bit more about our study. So let me just give you a little bit of background on the study. So there have been, clearly obesity rates have been skyrocketing. Everybody's familiar with that. There have been prior publications that suggest that by the year 2030 or 2050, you're going to see obesity rates well above 50, 60, or even 70%. And basically, these prior studies have plotted past obesity prevalence estimates from NHANES or various studies and straight-lined a trajectory and said, boy, we're going to see these rapid increases in obesity prevalence given past history. And as you know, as we talked about extensively this morning, obesity prevalence tends to be steadying off, right? So the extent to which it's steady or just the trend is decreasing is something we'll talk a little bit more about. But certainly, the rise is increasing at a decreasing rate. And so Justin and I talked about this, and we talked with CDC, and we said instead of just modeling future obesity rates based on past obesity rates, let's try to identify those variables that are predictive of rising rates of obesity, create a model that correlates those variables with rates of obesity, and then predict what's going to happen with those variables and use that to predict future increases in obesity rates. And so the variables that I'm talking about are changes in the demographic mix of the population. We looked at factors such as the annual unemployment rate. We looked at a variety of price indices, including the price of alcohol, the price of fuel. We looked at the price of fast food. We looked at the price of healthy food relative to unhealthy foods, as well as grocery to non-grocery items. And then we also added into our model additional factors, such as a number of fast food and full-service restaurants per 10,000 individuals, as well as internet access, which is, we think, a proxy for new technologies. Now, you heard this morning that there's a difference between NHANES and BRFSS, and NHANES certainly has some advantages. Well, for us, BRFSS has an advantage in that it's measured at the state level. So we were able to take advantage of state-level variation in all of the variables that I just mentioned in order to identify our model. So we corrected in our study for the self-reporting issues related to self-reported height and weight in BRFSS and measured height and weight in NHANES. So we did adjust for that, but we used the BRFSS data because that's the data set that had the state level variation that our model was able to take advantage of. And then we also relaxed this assumption of a linear forecast and estimated a model that would allow for this sort of leveling trend. And so based on that model, we were able to use the predictions in all of these explanatory variables that we found and use that to predict future obesity rates. And so the big headlines that you've seen in this paper are that we predict that by the year 2030, obesity rates will increase 42%, which is significantly less than the 50-plus percent that some of the prior estimates were, but it's certainly greater than a zero percentage increase, right? And in fact, for severe obesity prevalence, which is people who are roughly 80 pounds or more overweight, we're predicting an increase of more than double, up from roughly 5% today to 11% in the future. And in fact, basically, one of the things we say in the story is that because of these rising prevalence estimates and growing population, there's going to be roughly 32 million obese adults in the U.S. by 2030, and that would mean an increase of almost $550 billion in total between now and 2030 due to rising costs of obesity. Or another way to think about that number is if we could keep obesity rates flat, or if obesity rates truly were flattening, we would save $550 billion. And so those are the main take-home points in the paper. So now what I'd like to do is stop and entertain as many questions as you guys have and try to clarify any questions or differences between, say, NHANES or BRFSS or other implications of the study.
And just a couple of quick logistical comments. First of all, if you would identify yourselves, please. And secondly, if you could use a handheld mic so that people on the line can hear you. We'll go between the room and the phone lines. Any questions from the room?
On the phone lines, if you'd like to ask a question, press star one at this time.
With AP. Dr. Dietz, if I could just get you to address exactly what kind of prevalence are we talking about for the average person who does not know about differences in data sets and this kind of technical level issue. It sounds like what you're saying is we're leveling off, but we're still seeing these smaller rises that are going to get us to, combined with the population rise, a total prevalence of 42%. Is that what you're saying?
The current prevalence is 34% in adults and 17% in children and adolescents. That's based on NHANES data. We don't have comparable pediatric data from anything, but the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, and as the data that Cynthia Ogden presented this morning, there's a twofold underestimate of self-reported height and weight. In other words, if you look at measured versus self-reported, it's about it's twice as great in measured. That's less of a disparity on the adult side. It's about a 25 to 30% difference between self-report and measured. And in the paper, we corrected the data for that disparity. So that, in some respects, corrected the underestimates of prevalence that come from BRFSS to NHANES. Now, the whole issue of a plateau or not depends on where you start to look and what data set you're looking at. Because if you start with the NHANES data alone and look forward, there are people in the field who would argue that the current plateau is actually within the limits of that continuing acceleration. We chose to use the behavioral risk factor surveillance system starting somewhat later than 1970 and capitalizing on the trends that are occurring within states. And that's really the two major differences are state-specific data and self-reported data, and we tried to correct for one of those two variables by adjusting the BMI data from BRFSS to the NHANES levels. Does that answer your question? No? Okay.
For the average person who is going to have a really hard time figuring out how you can say it's leveling off, but you're still going to have a 33% rise to get to 42% prevalence, Answer that, please.
It depends on what you look at.
So which one do we believe?
Well, my own belief is that the slope has changed, and as Cynthia pointed out, it depends which group within the population you're looking at, because the boys are still continuing to increase, particularly African American boys. If you look at a trend analysis, it does suggest that women are flat. There's a lot more variation among men. And as she pointed out, if you just look from, I think it was 1999, 2000 to 2008, there's still like a 6% increase in men, although recently it seems to plateau. So if you just look at the most recent data, the 1997-98 forward, men are flat, but if you look back starting with 1999 and then go forward, they're increasing. So it really is a matter of choice and reflects the kind of uncertainty that we have with respect to how things are changing. I don't know how I can answer it any better than that. Maybe Eric can or Justin.
Would you like to add anything, Eric, to that?
I'll give it a go. I mean, I guess what I would say is if you look at the NHANES overall estimates, even over the last couple of years, you see that the latest year is a teeny bit higher than the prior year. It just turns out it's not statistically different. And so statisticians will say, since it's not statistically different, we can't reject the hypothesis that they're flat. But it doesn't mean they're flat. It just means we can't reject their hypothesis. Now, the BRFSS data set is monumentally larger. And so that difference would be statistically significant if it were seen in the larger data set. And so I guess to put it very simply, I would say that the NHANES data shows a slight uptick. Our estimates are consistent with a slight uptick. We go from 34% to 42% in 18 years, which it doesn't take a huge increase in the curve to get there. And so to some extent, I think the data sets aren't telling different stories. I think if the NHANES data set were larger, you would say it's a small but statistically significant difference between the two.
That's fair to say. Much better than my explanation.
Right here.
David Brown from the Washington Post. Your data is projected data. And as you've said a couple times, it comes from a deeper time point in the past than what Dr. Ogden was showing. She showed, I thought, quite convincingly that there has been variation in this growth over the last, this trend in American health over the last 30 years. And that it was flat in the 60s, went up steeply in the 80s and 90s, and now it's flattened off. Putting aside the issue of whether these are all within confidence intervals of each other, and to get to Lauren's question, I would think the ordinary reader would say, okay, let's take the most recent actual data, which is the last 8 years, I guess, that Dr. Ogden was, and she showed convincingly across almost all ethnic groups, races, sexes, everything, that it's basically leveling off or it's going up so marginally that it's effectively level. Why should we not believe that is the trend that is going to continue on, since that's actual data, rather than this modified linear extension from a point in which we know the trend that you're trajectory set, we know has changed. You know, the slope has changed from the one that you're using. Because it seems to me that there's no way to really square what she showed and what you're predicting.
So, a very thoughtful question. For sure, it's a challenge. Now, our model, too, takes into account the latest data and allows for that possibility of a flattening trend. And so we do model that. Now, we, you know, as I said, we use the state-level data, and we incorporate all of these additional variables to try to do the best possible job that we can in making these predictions. And as I said, we don't actually predict future obesity rates by taking into account past obesity rates. We look at the trends in these other variables. And so you might argue that if these variables were to change, like the relative price of fast food or fast food density or prices of you know, grocery to non-grocery items, or any recession changes, you might see the trend go straight up or go down. And so our model tends to account for these underlying variables. And so that, I think, is the main difference. Now, even with that said, I would say if you did our exact model with exactly as you described it, with the last couple years of the BRFSS data, because it's showing a slightly greater slope than in Haynes, I think you'd pretty much get what we got regardless. Now, it doesn't take much of a difference between the slopes of the NHANES and the BRFSS to go from 34% to 42% in 18 years. But I should point out, I mean, I actually feel very comfortable in these estimates, and in fact, the difference that we're seeing for severe obesity, where we're showing a more than doubling, is actually consistent if you look at the among the obese population, if you look at the average weight of that group, it continues to go up. And our data supports that, and the NHANES data supports that, especially among minority populations. And so are we going to be right? Who knows? And the reality is, you know, the data is always based on the past. It's like trying to predict the stock exchange in the future. I mean, as things change, as the environment changes, as new programs come out, as new drugs and technologies come out, those things will matter, but we can't model that because we don't have access to future information. And so, you know, I think these are very reasonable estimates of what the future will hold given the way the past is held. But they're estimates. And they'll, you know, like any estimate, we think they're useful, but are they going to be accurate? Well, time will tell. And if they're not accurate, it's likely because the world has changed in such a way that makes the estimates no longer appropriate. Hope that's a reasonable answer to your question.
Let's pause for a minute from the room and go to the phone. Any questions on the phone?
Thank you. We do have a question on the phone lines, and if you'd like to ask a question, just press star one. Our first question comes from Adrian Arisquillo from NBC Latino. You may ask your question.
Hello, everybody. What did you find concerning Hispanic Americans? How did their data compare to the overall numbers?
So I can tell you that in our model, minority populations, both African American and Hispanics, were predictive of greater rates of obesity as well as greater rates of severe obesity. So consistent with the past data, those groups are likely to see larger increases than the non-Hispanic white population.
Other questions from the phone?
And we do have a question from Melissa Healy with Los Angeles Times. You may ask your question.
Hi, thanks so much for doing this. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how rates of overweight, too, how they trend and how that trend compares with the rates of obesity. In other words, are a greater number of people leaving the overweight category and moving into the obese category or what? And I wonder whether, given these kinds of projections, I take it you obviously cannot do, you cannot make any estimates of children, but young adults, can you break down any age brackets that would be meaningful?
So I think there were a couple questions embedded in there. Let me answer the best that I can. First off, we did not specifically model rates of overweight or those in the BMI 25 to 30 range, but certainly it's reasonable that if rates of obesity and severe obesity are going up, it needs to come from somewhere else. And so we would expect to see it would be at the expense of the overweight as well as the normal weight. Now, two other points. In terms of age, consistent with the current data, those who are age 45 to 64 were most likely to be obese or severely obese. And so that's the age group. As people move more into that age group, we see rates of obesity higher. And so the changing demographic of the population is partly responsible for rising rates of obesity. Now your final point concerns youth. In this paper, we didn't actually use data from youth, but I've published in the past as well as others. There's a very unfortunate correlation that if you're an overweight kid, you're going to almost be destined for sure to be an obese adult. And so as rates of childhood obesity increase, so too would we expect to see that's going to increase rates of obesity in the future. And so that's a major challenge we have and really speaks to the importance both for addressing childhood obesity today as well as the potential benefits of adult obesity down the road. And you may have some additional comments.
Just to add to that, we know that about 50% of severe obesity in adults is a consequence of persistent obesity from childhood. So what we may be seeing now with the increases is the past increases in the prevalence of childhood obesity that's now persisting.
Other questions from the phone?
At this time, I'm showing no further questions. And again, if you'd like to ask a question, press star 1.
Other questions from the room?
Yes, David Brown again. Can you describe the direction that these different variables have on obesity rates, you know, alcohol price, gas prices, fast food, number of restaurants per 10,000? Some of them are obvious, but some of them aren't. And also, can you talk about how you use those variables? Presumably there is a slope of increase of all of those from the past, and did you linearly extend that? Did you adjust it for better economy later on? Or there's a lot of moving parts, it seems.
That's right. Great question. And so, of course, we need to make some assumption about how all of these variables would move in the future. And so I can walk you through what we hypothesized going in, and then I can tell you a little bit about how we predicted the future or attempted to predict the future. But certainly things like internet access, which we think is a proxy for sedentary technology, our assumption was, well, as internet access increases, that's going to make people more sedentary, and so we would expect that to positively influence rates of obesity. Fast food restaurants or the number of restaurants, well, if it's easier to access these restaurants, people would eat out more. We know food in restaurants is more calorie dense than food at home, and so we expected that too would increase rates of obesity. The relative price of healthier versus non-healthy foods, if healthier foods become relatively more expensive relative to less healthy foods, we thought people would switch out and consume more of those less healthy foods. If food overall becomes more expensive relative to non-food items, we worry that people would switch to the cheaper, more calorie-dense foods, and that too would be increase obesity rates. Same story with fast food prevalence. Fuel prices, our hypothesis here, this is tricky, but the idea is if you have very low fuel prices, people will drive more and walk less. Alcohol, we figured alcohol is certainly high calorie, and so if the prices of alcohol go down, people would consume more alcohol, and they might end up gaining weight. And so those were generally the primary hypothesis and why we chose these variables, and in fact, there was, you know, certainly some theories to suggest all of these things mattered. There are other things that we think would influence obesity rates, you know, such as programs and what have you, but we didn't have access to those data. So this is what we had. And so essentially what we did is we looked at the trends in these variables over the period of analysis, and then we modeled those trends. We fit sort of a best fit curve. And so sometimes it looked pretty linear, sometimes it looked sort of curvy linear, and so we forecasted. So for example, internet access, you know, in 1990 when we started our study was like 2 or 3%, and I think by the 2008 it was, I don't remember the number, but it was certainly well above 50%, closer to 60-something percent. And so, of course, that could never go above 100%, but at some point we think it would peak. And so we fit what we thought was a reasonable logistic-looking line for that curve. And then so we took all of these variables and we took our predictions and we ran them through our model, and that's how we came up with our estimates. Now, I do want to make clear, predicting obesity is tricky, and no one variable showed up as being the cause of obesity. And I certainly don't think that'd be surprising, because if we knew what that was, we would change it. So these things in and of themselves combined were predicted. But our entire model only explained about 5% of the variation in rates of obesity across individuals, which isn't that surprising because it's really hard to predict who's going to be obese and who's not, and there's genetics and environment and gene-environment interaction and lots of factors. And so, we think the model certainly has some explanatory power, but predicting obesity is tough business, and there's so many factors at play here that this is a challenging task to undertake. That's helpful.
Go one more time to the phones. Any questions on the phone?
We do have several questions. Our first one comes from Elise Vebeck with The Hill newspaper. You may ask your question.
Hi there. Thank you very much. I'm interested in the fuel price variable in particular, and I'm curious what you found exactly on that question, and also what your findings could mean for other policymaking. Those decisions might be outside of the anti-obesity fight per se, but it still seems relevant when we're talking about the explanatory power of the study. Thank you very much.
So fuel prices actually did not show up statistically significant in either our obesity model or our severely obese model, and I could certainly speculate about why that could be. Maybe people didn't change their behavior or they carpooled, but we didn't see any real change there. Now, that's not to say that maybe long-term sustained fuel prices wouldn't generate any changes, but over the period of analysis and the variation in fuel prices that we saw, we didn't see anything. Maybe for policy implications, I don't know if you have any comments, Dr. Dietz?
No, I don't. I think it's hard to speculate on policy implications of a model with projections.
Other questions from the phone?
Yes, we have a question from Katie Leslie with Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You may ask your question.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I am hoping you can speak about your predictions for various parts of the country, specifically the South. And I'm curious to know if, obviously, we generally, I believe, have higher rates of obesity. Is there an expectation we'll have higher or faster increases in the rate of obesity or severe obesity moving forward?
That's a good question. Now, I should say I don't have an answer for you because our model uses the state-level variation to generate the forecast. So that makes it hard for us to make predictions, say, for any particular state. So our model is a national model that uses data across states. Now, certainly, you could probably speculate if states have very different prevalence of fast food or very different changes in any of these variables that we described, demographics or relative prices or other factors, how that might influence the results. But in this analysis, we were unable to undertake specific state-level or regional-level variation solely because we needed that variation just to come up with our national estimates.
Other questions on the phone?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Nellie Bristow with Congressional Quarterly. You may ask your question.
Hi. I was wondering, I know you said that you couldn't really take into account policies to any degree or to much degree, but I'm wondering, could you look at things like efforts to address food deserts or menu labeling, that kind of thing? It seems like if you can take into account fast food, could you take into account more access to fresh fruits and vegetables and what that might mean for obesity?
So, as I said, in this analysis, we used the variables that we had access to at the state level. So if we didn't have access to it, that's why it's not in our model. Now, I can speak specifically to menu labeling because I've published on that in another study. And, in fact, in our study, we were unable to show in one particular fast food chain that menu labeling changed people's behavior in terms of calories per meal. Other studies have found some modest effects. And so I think the extent to which menu labeling is going to have an effect is yet to be seen. I think we may need to find longer-term studies to see the implications of that. same with other policies. I mean, if we can take those into account and follow those long term, I think we might have a better answer for you. But unfortunately, within the aspects of this paper, we just weren't able to do it. I don't know if you have any other comments.
No, I think it's an important question. And there is some modeling that's underway with a group that's called ComNet, which is going to be looking at how various policy initiatives may affect the prevalence. I think it's primarily of childhood obesity, but that work is just really getting underway.
Other questions on the phone?
At this time, I'm showing no further questions.
Final call, questions in the room? David and Lauren.
Yeah, it's David Brown again. Can you just describe a little, you mentioned that these different variables explain 5% of, I guess, what predicts obesity, which, you know, again, to a layperson doesn't seem like a lot. And yet you also said that these variables, you know, were really kind of where the action was, or in terms of, you know, setting the slope and where you end up. So if you could just sort of kind of explain that and what sort of things, obviously genetics is one of them, but what sort of things explains the other 95%?
That's a tough question. I mean, explaining 5% of variation in hard to understand things like obesity is actually about, it may sound bad, but it's not that far out of the ordinary. If like you were trying to predict, you know, who's going to be an alcoholic or who's going to get cancer, you wouldn't do much better. It's hard to do, so I don't really have a good answer to you. I mean, I don't know if you can think of a variable that is obvious that we're missing. I'm not sure what it is. And if we put it in our model, I suspect it wouldn't do much to our results. It's just, we know genetics, and I've heard of factors, people say that genetics explains up to 70% of the variation in individuals' weight. So if you believe that estimate, it means that 30% is left to be explained. And, you know, now Justin, for example, has published on peer effects. So maybe what's happening in your school or your community is explaining an additional couple percentage points. I actually wish we could have done a better job on built environment. I think built environment probably has a significant effect. The ability to walk and be active in your community certainly would matter. And so I think, you know, I was thinking that for kids, certainly the school environment, I think, is probably the single largest factor, and there's certainly data to show that it matters for kids. For adults, worksite wellness programs, for example, may have a significant effect. And in fact, I've certainly been involved in worksite studies, and we continue to study the effect of worksites on weight. By and large, what we see with all weight loss programs is you do see some short-term effect, but long-term sustained weight loss with any program is still largely elusive. Now, one other thing that I think it's fair to mention is that we don't talk about medicine or devices. And so certainly for some people, drugs that they take that even have weight gain as a side effect, or drugs that they take for weight loss like Ally or bariatric surgery, I mean, these things too would explain variation in weight. Certainly among the severely obese, those things actually have been proven quite effective. And so it matters to the extent that as these things change in the future and as new technologies and new programs come online, there'll be, if we can include those in our model, or better, if we include those in real life, we would expect to see those things actually matter.
Lauren Yearguard again. Could you give a little more discussion of the severe obesity? Because that was a pretty scary number to be doubling. What may be behind that?
So, I think that's a great question, and I think that's something that maybe we haven't talked so much about. So if you look at the rise in obesity prevalence going back to the 1970s until today, people have certainly seen the scary slopes and the slides from CDC. And I think lost in that discussion is that among the subgroup of individuals with a BMI over 30, their average weight continues to increase. And in fact, Dr. Ogden's numbers show that it's just a little bit in the last year or two, but over the past 10 years, for example, it's gone up tremendously. And now those individuals have significantly greater risk of diabetes and heart disease, and in fact a very large reduction in mortality compared to even those that have a BMI in the 30 to 35 range. They're also much more expensive. And so for that group, and actually the reality is, there's, other than the surgeries, there's not a lot that has proven helpful for those individuals. And so this is a group that's really at risk of great health implications, premature mortality, and yet they're increasing at an even greater rate than the rates of obesity. And you know, the explanation for that, I guess I would argue, is that the world has changed in such a way that allows people to be that overweight. I think 50, 60, 70 years ago, it would have been virtually impossible. You just couldn't sustain the excess caloric intake necessary to be that heavy. But now you can, and so given people's predispositions and gene-environment interaction and inactivity and workplace technology and access to unhealthy foods, people can actually be that heavy and are continuing to do so at increasing rates despite of the health implications. So I think it's a major challenge, and in fact I think we really need to concern ourselves about the prevalence and cost of that subset of the population.
And just to reiterate what I said earlier, there have been very few studies which have looked longitudinally at what happens to children who are overweight in childhood and who remain overweight as adults. The one exception to that is the Bogalusa study in Louisiana, which now has 30 years of follow-up data on children who were overweight or obese. And as I said, about 50% of adults in Bogalusa with severe obesity, meaning a BMI greater than or equal to 40, were obese as children or adolescents and had persistent obesity. One of the things which, just to add to what Eric said, if you look at the cost, they are proportionally increased or even disproportionately increased among the severely obese. The costs there are much greater than they are for just the somebody with a BMI between 30 and 35.
We have another person on the phone. Please ask your question.
We do have a question from China Millman with Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Let me ask your question.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I was wondering whether you considered income inequality and changes in income inequality as one of your variables, or whether there is data available so that you could consider that.
That's a good question. We actually used unemployment rates in our model. We used race and ethnicity, and we did use household income, average household income within the state, but we didn't look specifically at relative inequality. Now, I suspect if we could get at really fine-grained neighborhood-level variables, this variable might have some explanatory power. But at the state level, I don't think it would have helped us very much because there's so much within neighborhood variation that wouldn't be captured in a state-level model. But to your point, there certainly is some research that shows being sort of relative disparity within your community puts pressure on certain individuals and may have some effects, but our model wasn't able to take that into account.
One last call for questions in the room. Thank you very much for your participation. Just to remind folks, if you have additional questions or would like any more resources, Cassie Strawn and Rachel Cicerone, their names are in your press packets, will be available to line up the appropriate responses. Thank you very much for attending today, and thanks for everyone on the phone as well.
Thank you. This does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation. At this time, you may disconnect your line.